When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, Simran, I'm going to list some classic songs from the year 2000 and you're going to tell me what they have in common. Pure Shores by All Saints, Independent Women Part 1 by Destiny's Child, Can't Fight the Moonlight by Leanne Rimes, Try Again by Aaliyah, Doesn't Really Matter by Janet Jackson.
Well, first of all, every single one of them is a banger. And secondly, movies. Each one of these songs was on an original motion picture soundtrack.
It's both weird and fascinating that all of these tracks have outlasted the movies they were attached to. Take Janet Jackson as an example. That tune is from Nutty Professor 2, The Clumps.
I mean, let's be real, it's no Nutty Professor 1. But yes, that song and that soundtrack tell us something about how the relationship between pop music and Hollywood was playing out in the early noughties.
In this episode, we ask some questions about that relationship and how it's changed over the last 20 years.
And get some answers by talking to legendary, and I mean legendary, record executive and music supervisor Kathy Nelson, who's going to help us understand the art of and business behind a great soundtrack.
You know, I think it's about having a collection of songs that are true souvenirs of the movie in the best possible way.
It's the 21st century. The future is now. Now.
The winner of Big Brother is...
What date is a commuter going to think it is when we get to 2000?
Welcome to 2020, a pop culture podcast by Message Heard. I'm Tara Joshi.
And I'm Simran Hans. This is the podcast where we go back to some of the biggest pop culture moments from the year 2000 and re-examine them from a fresh, critical perspective.
Last week, we talked about The Sims. A special thanks to everyone who sent in voice notes about how they murdered their Sims. We value your honesty.
This week, we're talking about movie soundtracks.
Simran, why? How did we come up with the idea for this episode?
So I started very dorkily making a list of great pop songs from the year 2000, and I noticed that a significant handful of them appeared on movie soundtracks. When I looked into the individual songs more closely, I discovered that not only did they appear on soundtracks, but many of them wouldn't necessarily have even been released without the movies they were promoting. I found it super interesting that the songs themselves have gone on to have greater legacies than the movies they were in. I wanted to understand how and why these incredible pop songs got made, who paid for them, and why the movie tie-in single isn't really a thing anymore. There was really only one person who I wanted to talk about this with, Kathy Nelson, the music supervisor for Coyote Ugly and one of the masterminds behind Can't Fight the Moonlight.
Hi, I'm Kathy Nelson, and I believe I'm here to discuss my very long career in film music, soundtracks and film music.
Kathy's credits are laughably impressive. As a music supervisor, she worked on 16 Candles, Miami Vice, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, Dangerous Minds, Armageddon, High Fidelity, Brokeback Mountain, and so, so many more. It's worth taking a look on her IMDb page, where she's also listed as music guru on the credits for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which, what a dream.
I'm obsessed with that. She started off as a secretary at RCA Records in LA, and she worked her way up to an A&R job at MCA Records, which is a division of Universal, where she was eventually put in charge of soundtracks in the early 1980s. Her first credit is 16 Candles in 1984.
So it's worth noting that at this point, music supervision as we know it today wasn't yet an established career. And today, the job role will still vary production to production, But broadly speaking, a music supervisor is the person who oversees the use of music in a film, TV show, or video game. This includes the score, pre-existing pop songs, and songs written specifically for the film. They work with the director to choose music that will help to tell the story and build the world of the film. And they also take care of legalities that come with this, so stuff like negotiating and licensing the music.
Kathy worked as the head of film music for Disney and went on to become the president of film music for Universal Music Group and Universal Pictures, a role that didn't exist before her tenure. As well as being a pioneer in her field, she's also an incredible storyteller.
I mean, when she made reference to her friend Johnny and it transpired she was talking about John Cusack, I died a little bit.
Or when she told us about how she managed to get period country music for Brokeback Mountain by courting the most liberal country music star she could think of, Willie Nelson. She went to the Staples Center, she went to his trailer, and she asked him if he'd have his music in a gay love story, and he said yes. Aside from the mind-blowing name drops, our conversation with Kathy gave us an insight into how music can really make or break a movie, as well as the financial and legal considerations she had to make, all the while working creatively with directors to soundtrack their films. We learned why the movie soundtrack as a thing took off in the 90s and noughties and got the behind the scenes of how a song like, say, Gangster's Paradise gets made.
As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I take a look at my life and realize there's nothing left, because I've been blasting and laughing so long that...
While Gangster's Paradise was released in 1995, the story of how Kathy made the song a thing shows just how influential her role had become in both film and music. In fact, the success of that song, which was created for Dangerous Minds, starring Michelle Pfeiffer, was the reason Kathy got hired by Disney.
They first tested it with pop music, you know, a Beck song and Counting Crows, and the preview was a disaster. I think people walked out.
And so Kathy had a brainwave to soundtrack the film with hip-hop music.
I knew that Michelle Pfeiffer was not just a beautiful white actress. She was the star of Scarface. And Scarface was like the hip-hop Bible. And so nobody else really thought about it that way. But I did. And I called Coolio, who had a song called Fantastic Voyage out. And I said, do you want to write a song for this movie? You know, I'm working on this movie. I can come and show you some footage. And he was totally down for it.
With Coolio on board, they created Gangster's Paradise. But it was far from an instant success. No one would play it on the radio. What they needed was a music video that they could play on MTV.
Michelle became a friend of mine during the making of this movie, and she was a producer on the movie, so she cared. And she said, you know, I'm not a hip-hop girl, but I'll be in a video if you can think of how it would make sense. And so I kind of sketched out an idea of a concept for the video. Jerry Bruckheimer hired Antoine Fuqua, who I believe this was his first video. He came from the commercial world.
But MTV wouldn't play the video either, and so they took it straight to the top. The film's producers, Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, went directly to the chairman of Disney and showed him the video. And he loved it. In fact, he loved it so much that he threw the existing marketing campaign out the window and bought up all the TV and radio spots he could just to air the video.
The song took off and the movie opened to, I believe, $100 million at a number one position. It was a crazy story.
Through this story and so many others, Kathy helped us understand that by the late 90s and early noughties, the relationship between Hollywood and pop had gotten even savvier. Film soundtracks could be an effective marketing tool for both the movie and the artist.
You know, I think it's about having a collection of songs that are true souvenirs of the movie in the best possible way. And of course, the music has to have been important in the movie, which in a lot of cases it's not. In a lot of cases, it's the music are just needle drops and they're just meant to sort of fill the atmosphere, but they're not meant to be part of the storytelling or anything significant like that. And I think probably directors or producers, filmmakers started using music in a way that was more effective and more noticeable. And studios did start to realize that it could be a really helpful marketing tool in terms of releasing a movie. It would reach a demographic or a target audience that perhaps their normal channels of marketing, TV trailers and radio spots, whatever, wasn't doing.
It's worth saying that the idea of a movie soundtrack as part of a film's marketing is something that goes back a little bit further than the era that we've been talking about. So in 1952, you have the movie High Moon, which features the song Oh My Darling. And that song ended up being massive in the kind of promotion of the film. And so because it was a hit, a lot of studios kind of understood that as an opportunity and, you know, decided to commission artists to write original songs, thinking that they could kind of do a tie-in in this way.
So I think for me, this whole thing has been kind of revelatory because I think most of the songs from this era that we're talking about, I was not aware of their association with films. So Oh My Darling, I just sort of know as a song. I didn't know about the film. And another film that we have been talking about is The Graduate. And I did not realize that Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson was an original song made for that film. And obviously that song was a number one hit.
And like, not only were these songs kind of like massive hits, they were played on the radio, they were also a kind of massive source of ancillary revenue for the movies, right? So not only was it a good way of getting word out about the films, but it was another kind of revenue stream for the studios as well. I want to talk a little bit about the idea that a song can make a movie cool. I think Gangster's Paradise is like a perfect example of this because Dangerous Minds, as Kathy herself was sort of saying, not really a kind of cool movie. And yet once it got associated with that song, it gave it a new level of credibility.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just think I'm interested in watching that film now. And I had no real knowledge of that film prior to doing research for this, but knowing about the use of that song within it, I think, makes me much more interested in it. And I imagine, well, we'll get on to this a bit later, but, you know, obviously I wanted to watch Black Panther anyway, but the soundtrack that was created for that, I like knew off by heart before I had even seen the film. So I think there is that kind of idea that the music that comes with the film can be just as important to people. Even like Pulp Fiction, I think, is an example of that. Like, I've had so many people talk to me solely about the Pulp Fiction soundtrack.
Yeah, completely. And, you know, off the top of my head, there are some incredible pop songs, you know, throughout the history of the last 50 years that really wouldn't exist without movies. I'm going to list some of them just so you, like, get an idea of, you know, how ubiquitous the movie tie-in single is. So we've got 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton from the movie 9 to 5. Call Me by Blondie, which was made for American Gigolo. Get Into the Groove by Madonna, which wouldn't exist without Desperately Seeking Susan. The classic I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston, cover of Dolly Parton's song for The Bodyguard. And one of the best songs of the 90s, Don't Let Go by En Vogue, is from the movie Set It Off. So kind of like since The Graduate, which was 1967, 70s, 80s, 90s, you get these kind of crossover singles happening where massive songs that are really big in the culture come directly from movies.
Again, super embarrassing for me because I am very familiar with all of those songs, but with the exception of Whitney Houston and The Bodyguard, I had no idea about those associations with films. So this is a real learning curve for me.
I would highly recommend everybody goes and watches all of those movies because they are excellent.
Okay. Well, the movie single tie-in is evidently very smart marketing, but after a while, it does begin to feel a bit cynical. So in 1999, there was a Melissa Joan Hart and Adrian Grenier rom-com, and originally it was called Next to You, but they changed its name to Drive Me Crazy to highlight the Britney Spears song being on the soundtrack.
It's a little crass, but I guess you can kind of see what they were thinking off the back of the success of huge hits like R. Kelly's I Believe I Can Fly from Space Jam in 1996, Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On from Titanic in 97, and of course, Aerosmith's Don't Want to Miss a Thing from Armageddon in 1998. It's safe to say that by this point, studios are starting to get a little bit opportunistic.
Initially, when I would call a studio and say, hey, I've got this song that's going to be, you know, the title track for this movie, I was sort of annoying to them because, you know, they had a huge job, which was to put bodies in the seat opening weekend. Because in the movie business, for a very long time, unless you were a little indie film, you kind of lived and died in that first weekend. So once studios discovered that they could use a song to market a movie in a significant way, for a long time, that's the way it was done. And then, like with everything else, what ended up happening was studios just wanted to say, okay, what's your next single? We'll put it in the trailers. And the song would have nothing to do with the movie. It turned into just a marketing tool.
So you can have different types of movie music. There are the songs that are key to the plot of the film. So Can't Fight the Moonlight is pretty important to the plot of Coyote Ugly. And there are examples when there's a kind of thematic similarity happening, but they're not necessarily written for the film. So I'm thinking of songs like Independent Women by Destiny's Child, which is in Charlie's Angels, or Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus, which is in the movie Loser. Do you think it matters whether a song is kind of relevant to the themes or the content of the film? Something like Independent Women Part 1 appears in Charlie's Angels, and obviously, you know, three women being independent, kicking ass, it's, you know, you can see why they chose that song to tie in with the movie.
Like trying to think back to childhood Tara, for example, it definitely made me more interested in watching Charlie's Angels because, you know, the video kind of plays with the themes of the film and there are some sort of somewhat throwaway lyrics that reference Charlie's Angels, come on. And like, if it wasn't a group I loved so much, maybe I would be speaking about this differently, I'll admit. But in the case of that song...
Or maybe if the song wasn't so good, right?
Yeah, like it ultimately was a really good song and I think we'll get onto examples where that's not the case and therefore the link becomes grating and kind of bad.
But in the kind of list of songs from 2000 that, you know, we were talking about at the top of the episode, there are some tracks that don't really have anything to do with the films at all, but they're still kind of good. I'm thinking Try Again, which is in Romeo Must Die, doesn't really have anything to do with the movie.
No. Well, I actually have to be honest, this is just like a theme of this episode. Like, I haven't seen Romeo Must Die, so I don't know what the plot of that is, but I love that song. And the music video where they're sort of in the like Hall of Mirrors, it does seem cool. It makes me want to watch the movie, whatever it is.
Exactly. It's clever marketing and... You know, it's worth noting that Aaliyah is in the movie. And, you know, we said at the beginning, with Janet Jackson, Doesn't Really Matter, which is in Nutty Professor 2, The Clumps, she also stars in that movie. So you can kind of see why a record executive or a movie executive wouldn't want to waste the opportunity for using the artist when they've already kind of got them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, again... It's embarrassing that I think I remember more of Nutty Professor 2, The Clumps, than I do of Romeo Must Die, so forgive me for this. But isn't the whole thing that it doesn't matter what he looks like, and that's why there's a Doesn't Really Matter link? Maybe we shouldn't get into this. I'm mis-selling the movie, maybe, and I really don't ever want to rewatch it, so...
I hadn't thought about the kind of literal interpretation of the song.
But yeah, I mean, if you were just listening
but
to the
tenuous,
song,
it's right?
Very
tenuous. It's tenuous.
It's me using my like English lit A-level kind of linking.
I guess, you know, if we're thinking about the deals that might be struck around movie music, then maybe in the case of Janet Jackson, it would have been negotiated into her contract. And I'm kind of interested to know which way around it went, whether she agreed to be in the movie on the basis that they would feature her on the soundtrack, or she like wanted to have her song in the movie, so she had to be in it as well.
I sort of imagine it was her wanting to do the acting rather than her being like, you have to have my
She'd seen Nutty Professor 1 and she was like, I need to be in the sequel of that.
I hope so. I haven't read enough about this, but I know what I'm doing this evening.
In the case of Leanne Rimes, who does the music for Coyote Ugly, and we'll kind of get into this in more detail later, they actually ended up putting her in the film in the sort of climactic scene as a condition of her doing the music. So they were like, we want her to be in the film. They thought that was sort of like good promotion for her. And that was negotiated. So I think it does work both ways.
And an example of that that I think is kind of interesting as regards, you know, someone who is playing quite a main role, but also has the main song is, and how many times in this series will I bring up Beyoncé? Who knows? But Beyoncé and Austin Powers in Goldmember. So she plays Foxy Cleopatra, I think is the character name. And she also does the incredible song, Work It Out. And I'm not sure, because this is around the time that she is trying to break into acting more. And even though it seems kind of surreal now, at the time, Austin Powers was like a really big thing. So her being in that must have felt like a really like strong career move, like being the main woman in that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to know how that deal went down in the room, but I imagine it was something like, okay, I'll do a track for your film, but you have to put me in the movie. Because I really don't think, I don't know if like Austin Powers' Goldmember is before or after Carmen, a Hip Hopera, which is one of Beyoncé's early roles, but in film. But I don't imagine that they would have cast her off the strength of her acting.
Yeah, no, I imagine in that case it was very much a, please do a song for us and fine, then we'll cast you. I mean, again, an interesting example of someone being in the film, but also making the song for it is Alia with Try Again. And I think that's a really good example of like the link of marketing between song and film, because Try Again was the first song to top the Hot 100 based off airplay alone. And that's because it was only on the soundtrack at first. It wasn't a single. So if you wanted to own that song, you actually had to buy the soundtrack.
If you ever notice a particular track in a film or a music video associated with a movie and find yourself thinking, how did this collaboration happen? What became clear through talking to Kathy is how last minute these collaborations could be, largely due to where music sits in the pecking order of production.
There are a lot of filmmakers that, because music is the last thing that happens in making a movie, you're usually almost out of time, almost out of money, because every other department has borrowed from the music budget to make up for their overages. So, and a lot of filmmakers are too nervous that they can't really imagine that an original song is going to be like a home run and exactly what they want. It's easier to find a pre-existing song and use it, because then you know exactly what you're getting. And there are certain artists that I would have never asked for an original song from, because they were such revered songwriters to me that I would never want to run the risk of having them write an original song for a film I was working on and having it not be accepted or not liked. So it's very common to try to get an original song as your title track or your main track, because that's the only way you can get nominated for an Academy Award. And once soundtracks became successful and meaningful and a viable source of income for record companies, that became something very important. Can your song be nominated? And if it had already been recorded and already out, it could not be nominated for an Academy Award.
It was a gamble to put that time and attention into creating an original song, but it could also really pay off in a way that using pre-existing pop music couldn't. I mean, winning an Academy Award is some of the best marketing your film can get.
But original songs don't have to be Academy Award winning to be massively successful, or to work as genius promotional material for the films that they're in. We wanted to ask Kathy about a little film she worked on called Coyote Ugly, whose flagship song is Leanne Rimes' Can't Fight the Moonlight. You can try. Try to hide from my kiss, but you know, the Moonlight was a huge hit. And as for the soundtrack, it was so successful that they actually released a follow-up, More Music from Coyote Ugly, in 2003.
Yeah, it's very much like a sleepover movie.
The same for me.
Yeah.
Like, we were 8 in the year 2000, as you know, regular listeners will know. So we probably weren't going to the cinema to see this movie. Although, like, it's worth saying that the sort of the background to Coyote Ugly is that it's based off this amazing GQ long read by Elizabeth Gilbert, she of Eat, Pray, Love fame, which kind of looks at the real life bar that the movie is based on. It's a sort of like dirty, gritty, saloon style bar in the Lower East Side, completely run by women. And the movie takes this long read and turns it into something that's way more kind of sanitized and, you know, teen girl friendly. It's interesting to me the way they sort of like tidied it up and gave it a PG-13 certificate. So it was probably like a bit racy for us as 8-year-olds, but, you know, as 12-year-olds, it really was a staple.
Yeah, 100%. And so, I mean, because it's set in a bar, and we'll get into the narrative of it, but I think it's fair to say that in the way that Kathy was talking about films where the soundtrack is actually very important to the narrative, this is very much one of those films.
Completely. Like, the jukebox is a key kind of component of the story. And, you know, the way they kind of seduce their customers and make money is by dancing provocatively, albeit very well, on top of the bar. I think Piper Perabo herself, she called it like stiletto feminism kind of move. I think, you know, if the film was made today, it would be very different. I think maybe the politics of it would be a little bit different. But it's a pretty fun movie. And the soundtrack, quite frankly, slaps.
100%. Okay, so we're getting very excited about this. But for anyone who hasn't seen Coyote Ugly, can you tell me a bit about what it's about?
So in the movie, Violet is a small town girl who moves to New York, wants to be a singer-songwriter, and she starts working in a bar to kind of make money while she's working on her songs in her spare time. She's played by Piper Perabo, and spoiler, Can't Fight the Moonlight ends up being the song in the film that wins her a record deal in the climax. So it's a really good example of what Kathy mentioned earlier, where the music in the film is integral to the plot.
In order to believe that she's a credible musician, you need to see her actually writing songs in the film. These scenes are super fun to watch, but by the sounds of what Kathy told us, they're much harder to film.
You know, the movie was about a girl who wanted to be a singer-songwriter. So it was very intentional to use all songs, original songs, that the actress was supposedly writing and performing. It was important to me that we use the same songwriter, or at least use all songs from that same songwriter, so that it sounded like a believable story. Because generally, artists do have a style. I mean, you kind of know a Joni Mitchell song when you hear it. You kind of know an Eagles song when you hear it. You know what I mean? So I wanted all the songs to have been written by Diane Warren.
Just to jump in here, Diane Warren is a hugely successful songwriter who has been nominated for Best Original Song at the Academy Awards 11 times.
None of them were written specifically for the movie, but I needed to be able to have the songs for filming because I needed Trevor Horn, the producer, to be able to deconstruct them. So we would have scenes where, like on when she's on the rooftop. So you see how the song became the song. Trevor Horn's a pretty phenomenal producer. Trevor Horn, you and I could have a hit record if Trevor Horn produced it.
So originally, Piper Perabo went into the studio to record with Trevor Horn. But her voice wasn't quite right, and so it was decided a professional singer should come in and redub the songs. They originally hired someone whose name sadly hasn't made it into the various oral histories of this film, but we do know she recorded music which Piper would have lip-synced to. But then Jerry Bruckheimer decided he didn't like the sound of this new vocalist either. So a month before one of Kathy's major deadlines, they had to go back to the drawing board.
I didn't know what to do because I found out very late in the game, like maybe 4 weeks before our final dub, that I had to replace the singer. It was quite daunting. I mean, you know, we all have selective memories. You know, now I can talk about it, how exciting, how fun it was. It was not fun. It was terrifying because I thought, what am I going to do?
One of the most promising names that was thrown into the ring for the role was a young country artist called Leanne Rimes.
She was a teenager, you know, and she was signed to Curb Records, which was also an MCA label. She was a country artist, and she was definitely an up-and-coming country artist, but I think she might have been like 17 years old or something crazy. She wanted to make a pop record.
So Kathy knew that Leanne liked one of the songs attached to the film, one of the songs Diane Warren had written, and she had heard on the grapevine that Leanne wanted to make a pop record. Kathy saw an opportunity, but she knew she had to tread very, very carefully.
Because I knew Mike Curb, and Mike Curb is a very difficult person to deal with if you don't approach him correctly.
Just a reminder for the listeners, Mike was the founder of Curb Records, Leanne's label at the time.
And I had worked with a lot of his artists, and I knew that I had to first approach him and hopefully get him to love the idea of approaching Leanne, not only to do one song, but do all of the songs. And so I called Mike Curb. We had this long discussion. I actually wanted it to kind of, I wanted him to sort of feel like it was his idea. And he definitely embraced the idea because I said, listen, she wants to make a pop record. You want to maintain her country base. And, you know, artists throughout all of this time, doing a soundtrack was really the only way that their managers, that their label would feel comfortable with them doing something that wasn't what their success was based on, doing something a little off center.
That's so telling, isn't it? That, you know, they weren't willing to let this absolutely massive teenage pop star, not pop star, country star, but, you know, somebody who clearly had the potential to be a crossover artist. They were so sort of risk averse that they thought, no, we're not going to do that. And, you know, the joke's on them because Can't Fight the Moonlight was a huge pop hit.
Yeah, I was reading something. It's still one of the biggest songs in Australia, just like ever.
Australia has good taste sometimes.
It's interesting to think about whether there are other examples of artists using a film soundtrack to experiment with their sound a little bit. I, off the top of my head, can think of Justin Timberlake on Inside Llewyn Davies, which, you know, up until that point in his music career, ultimately he had all the sort of squeaky pop of NSYNC and then the very sexy R&B stylings of his solo career. And then he does Inside Llewyn Davies, which is about folk music.
Are you trying to tell me that Inside Llewyn Davies is responsible for Man of the Woods?
I would never want to blame anything for Man of the Woods, aside from Justin himself, you know. He knows what he did with that album. But also, arguably, and I might have my timings wrong on this actually, but Tyler, the Creator, he did the Grinch soundtrack before he did Igor. And
that's interesting. I didn't know that.
So, like, and I'm pretty sure that the Grinch soundtrack is a lot more kind of synth poppy, like a lot less straightforward rap than what you heard on Flower Boy. So I think it may be, from his label's perspective and from his perspective, just gave him the chance to experiment with that side of things a bit more before going all out on Igor.
I think an interesting example to think about is Lady Gaga's soundtrack for A Star Is Born, because I think that's almost kind of doing the opposite, because she had had Joanne, right? Joanne had come out and it had been a critical failure. I actually think Joanne is pretty good.
Okay, controversial take, but...
Yeah, very controversial take. I think Joanne has some good tracks, but people didn't really respond to her in that kind of more earnest, more guitar-driven, more kind of country-ish sound. And yet, the Star Is Born soundtrack was huge.
Yeah, that was really bizarre for me because I've never watched A Star Is Born. I just think I would hate it. I'm just going to be real with you, and I hope this doesn't end this friendship because it
or
looks
this
like
podcast.
It might. Honestly, I'll just see myself out. I was going to say this seems like a brave thing to have admitted. Now, can we just pretend I didn't say that? No.
So you've never seen it?
I've never seen it because I don't think I would like it. But I feel like the look you're giving me. I feel like. It was really interesting in the aftermath of it, like how much people were talking about the songs and like people were like playing the songs at like parties I go to or whatever. And it was kind of ubiquitous, which I couldn't think of a film soundtrack that had done that at around that time.
In any case, Kathy was able to get Leanne and her team on board to re-record all the songs in Coyote Ugly. But there was still another challenge to overcome. They would have to retrofit her vocals to match the performance on screen.
Because Piper had already performed all the songs in the movie already, the vocals had to match her performance. And we were taking out the vocals and putting in a new vocalist, when in fact, the way it's really done is the actor lip syncs to the singer and, you know, they perform it to the recording so that it looks like you're singing with, you know, because your body movement, your body language has a huge effect on how you're singing a song. What we didn't realize is that she could do what's the equivalent in acting called looping, where looping is when an actor, maybe during a scene or two or whatever, muffles their line and you don't go back and reshoot the scene. You bring the actor into a recording booth and you play the scene and the actor revoices their line so that it's clear or more pronounced. But she had to actually, Leanne had to get in front of the screen and sing to Piper's performance. So it looked like Piper was actually singing. The album, Leanne sings the way she wants to sing. So if you watch the movie and then you listen to the album, those are different versions of the songs.
And that wasn't the end of the drama for Kathy. There was still another challenge to overcome, this time one of her own making.
That was kind of my idea, and it was kind of a naive idea because I wasn't really paying attention to the repercussions of what that meant in terms of the fact that the film had already been shot, the sets had already been torn down, the actors had already taken off and were doing other things. I had this idea because I knew she was going to record the one song. In talking her into doing all of the songs, I sort of said, you know, what if we put you in the last scene of the movie and you and Piper can do a duet of this song and you'll actually be in the movie? I didn't realize that I was really overstepping my boundaries a bit. There was a moment where I was confronted by, do you know how much money that's going to cost to rebuild the sets, to get the actors back? And I really didn't know what to say other than, do you want Leanne Rimes or don't you?
And in that final scene of the movie, I think the duet really pays off. What do you think about Leanne Rimes' kind of cameo in the end of the film?
Yeah, I guess it's interesting, again, as not really knowing how these sort of collaborations came about. You know, when I watch the film, I think that's a really joyous moment. But like to know the sort of difficulty she had in procuring that is quite funny now.
Definitely. And I guess the thing that I can't really wrap my brain around is the idea that there was a version of this film that existed that didn't have Leanne Rimes in it. I so associate that song and also kind of the music video for the song and her cameo in the kind of climax of the film. I really can't separate those two things.
Yeah, 100%. I rewatched the clip of her cameo. And just actually thinking about the fact that she's duetting with herself and just putting on a slightly different voice for how Piper sings. I think it's so impressive.
Okay, let's give a big coyote welcome to Leanne Rimes. You can try.
All of this said, big original marquee songs like Can't Fight the Moonlight are becoming much less common. And the nature of soundtracks have changed considerably since Coyote Ugly. Let's take a look at what they look like now.
In 2020, the rise of streaming has transformed all parts of the music and movie industries. This is something that Kathy touched on when we asked her about the big difference in showbiz since she, as she herself put it, moved out of the thick of it.
Now, an artist's success in some ways isn't even based on their songwriting and their vocal performance. It's based on how they've branded themselves. They all have makeup lines. Branding sort of took over. And in my thinking, hiring a Beyoncé to curate a soundtrack, because Beyoncé is a brand, that's your marketing tool.
I think that's really interesting what she said about the idea of sort of utilizing the brand of an artist to curate a soundtrack or to like bring in attention to a soundtrack.
I think it's probably worth pointing out as well that, you know, because of the transformation of the music industry and because it's nowhere near as profitable as it used to be, artists are having to find kind of alternative ways to make up that shortfall in other places. And so that is why, you know, so many singers have makeup brands or clothing lines or
skincare.
Yeah. So, you know, there are other ways that artists have tried to be kind of savvy and monetize themselves. So whether we think that's kind of right or not, you can understand why this has begun to happen. When, you know, an artist gets hired to curate an album, do you think that, you know, this can ever be a positive creative opportunity?
Yeah, 100%. You know, Kendrick Lamar on the Black Panther soundtrack, I think, is an excellent example of just really utilizing knowledge of different artists and bringing in really big names. So he has Future and SZA, but then, and Vince Staples, but then equally bringing in people who, you know, aren't known in like Western hip hop. So like he uses Yugen Blackrock, who's this, I want to say, South African rapper. And it's a way of showcasing artists and sort of celebrating them, as well as advertising the film, I guess.
Another kind of curated by soundtrack that I think is actually pretty good is the Lord Hunger Games one. Apparently she got approached to do the music for the movies because she loves the Hunger Games. I think she must have been pretty young at the time as well. She must have been, they're young adult books, and she must have herself been a teenager when she was kind of commissioning these songs. But some of them are pretty good. She got Kanye on there, she got Ariana Grande, she got Chemical Brothers, she got Haim, and a lot of those tracks kind of stronger than you would expect a soundtrack album to be. And I guess this is really the point that we're driving at, that when we think back to the movies of our childhoods, so many of those soundtracks in their entirety are really, really good. And now you might have a flagship single if you're lucky, but it's not as often that the kind of body of the soundtrack is as good.
Yeah, so I mean, at the same time as these good examples, there are also some bad examples.
Oh, can we talk about the failed attempts?
Okay, so The Great Gatsby.
Produced by Jay-Z.
Well,
and did you ever see the movie, by the way, the Baz Luhrmann version of The Great Gatsby?
I did, and I didn't like it.
It's not good. Which, you know, is disappointing from somebody like Baz Luhrmann, who has actually kind of made his name as a director who has incredible soundtracks. I think maybe that's why this one feels like kind of such a missed opportunity. You know, Romeo and Juliet has an incredible soundtrack. Moulin Rouge, if you like that kind of music, has a pretty good soundtrack.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing was with that as well was, you know, you can see how well curated those things are because, you know, like it draws from like even like different cultures. Like there's the Bollywood remix that which is great on Moulin Rouge. But I don't know, the Great Gatsby soundtrack just felt a bit not dissimilar to the film, just like.
For me, like the reason why that soundtrack doesn't work, even though it has these kind of huge names like Beyonce and Jay-Z, will.i.am, Lana Del Rey, is that it just feels so kind of shiny and corporate and hollow. And I guess, you know, that echoes the themes of the film, but not in a way that kind of really serves the material. I think it's like way too literal an interpretation of it. And instead, it should really evoke the mood of it more. And it just feels kind of very weird and disconnected. It doesn't really work for me. I also think that it's worth talking about Ariana Grande's Charlie's Angels soundtrack from 2019. Apparently she exec produced that.
I remember when the music video for the track with Ariana, Miley Cyrus and Lana Del Rey came out, Don't Call Me Angel. And I feel like everyone was really excited for that. And it was just so...
It was just so bad.
Yeah, and...
I can't even tell you, like, what that song goes like anymore. And isn't the video, like, Lana Del Rey looking particularly bored while the others sort of dance around a little bit, like, half-heartedly?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, when you have three artists like that, you kind of expect it to be, like... And particularly for a Charlie's Angels soundtrack, you know, when the precedent that has been set is Destiny's Child or, like, Pink even, you know, they're, like, they have fun music videos, like, and this was just very, it did almost take itself too seriously.
What is the Pink song that's in Charlie's Angels? Is it Trouble?
Yeah, in Full Throttle, I think it's Trouble.
And speaking of Pink as well, you know, one of Pink's most valuable contributions to the world of movie soundtracks is obviously Lady Marmalade from Moulin Rouge, which has Pink, Lil' Kim, Maya, Christina Aguilera.
It's incredible. It's so, so good.
And Missy Elliott. I was like, I'm forgetting someone here. Can't forget Missy Elliott. And you know, when you have all of those artists producing something as kind of joyful and brilliant as Lady Marmalade, you'd expect something similar from, you know, pop stars at the top of their game like Miley Cyrus or Ariana Grande or Lana Del Rey. And I can't work out whether it's just the combination that didn't work or the sort of style of music that they were singing or the fact that it took itself so incredibly seriously. Either way, as far as I'm concerned, like the movie, the soundtrack is a flop. And you know, the idea of an artist curated movie soundtrack isn't unprecedented. I'm thinking of Prince's soundtrack for Tim Burton's Batman in 1989 as a kind of earlier example of this.
It's a great soundtrack, and I think it's the one where you have the incredible scene with Jack Nicholson's Joker.
And then you have the soundtrack albums that land somewhere in the middle. A really interesting example of the contemporary soundtrack album is the 50 Shades of Grey soundtracks. Never thought I'd say that in earnest. So I've unfortunately seen all three of the films. First one, okay. Second one, very bad. Third one, even worse. But the soundtracks produced some pretty big pop hits, ones that seem to have endured in the culture way more than any of their contemporaries. I'm thinking of Love Me Like You Do by Ellie Goulding, which was written by Max Martin. That was a really big hit in 2015. And then they tried to kind of recreate the success of that with the second one, with Zayn and Taylor Swift's I Don't Want to Live Forever, which was still quite a good pop song.
I think it's a great song.
But I don't know if it sort of has the same ubiquity as Love Me Like You Do.
No, I think with both of them, and maybe this is an example of something we've touched on already, but because they are both just such giant stars that it's inevitable that it's a big song, but it's not maybe because of it being on the soundtrack.
Completely. And then with the third film, 50 Shades Freed, the lead track is a song by Hailee Steinfeld and Blood Pop. So you're sort of like, it's quite a good song, but it doesn't really have the same impact as the lead singles prior. And in terms of the sort of level of artists that they're able to get, again, like, each film is a slight downgrade. You know, you have Ellie Goulding and The Weeknd on, like, the first album, and then with the exception of kind of Taylor Swift and Zayn being the flagship stars of the second soundtrack, you also have a very strange track with Nicki Minaj and Nick Jonas, a collaboration that I personally wouldn't have dreamed up. And then, yeah, in 50 Shades Freed, you have Rita Ora, who is also in the film, and Liam Payne doing a song as well.
So, I mean, we've touched on Black Panther as an example of a curated soundtrack, and you know, Kathy referenced Beyonce, and she was of course talking about The Gift, which is the soundtrack that Beyonce curated for the Lion King remake. And I guess all of this points towards how soundtracks might be adapting and what we might see more of moving forward. Obviously right now is a really weird time to talk about this, because what happens with cinema and with music in this very weird transitional year, it's all very up in the air. So I don't know what that means for the soundtracking industry.
I think with Beyoncé and The Gift, the idea is really good. The idea that Beyoncé would go and kind of create an album of songs about Africa using artists across the diaspora. I think that's really kind of smart and in line with her kind of brand and her message. But in terms of the actual songs on the album, she has Burna Boy on there. She has Childish Gambino, who is in the film. But I don't really think that that album has stuck with me.
I think what was really interesting about that album is that when it came out around the time of the Lion King remake, I was so disinterested in the Lion King remake. And then like listening to the soundtrack and then listening to like the weird clips from the film that it has, I was just not interested in it. But, you know, when Black is King came out this year, which is Beyoncé's own film, and it's also a retelling of the Lion King story, and it's a visual album for The Gift. And then suddenly that album clicked for me a lot more. And then it just kind of made me think, well, you have this huge name attached to this soundtrack, but actually it works a lot better when it's just on her own terms. So I wonder if moving forward, you maybe even see, yeah, Beyoncé doing more with cinema and like just her doing her own soundtracks. Like maybe we see more musicians actually branching out into much wider territory than before. That's it for this week. A special thanks to our guest, Kathy Nelson. We hope you had as much fun listening to Kathy as we did talking to her. We're back next Tuesday with a very special roundtable on everyone's favourite mother-daughter duo, the Gilmore Girls.
Next week is the penultimate episode of the series. Thank you so much to everyone who's stuck with us so far.
And if you've been enjoying 2020, please take a few moments to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on your podcast app. It will help other people discover the show.
As always, you can find a list of all the things we've referenced today in the show notes, and you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at MH2020. 2020 is a Message Heard production, written and presented by me, Simran Hans, and the real muse of the Coyote Ugly Saloon, Tara Joshi. Produced and edited by Jake Hotayevich and Emily Wally. Sandra Ferrari is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Matt Huxley.